over on the...
Call the Capital Investment Committee meeting to order. Representative Erickson.
Thank you,
you
Chair.
You have a bill that somehow is connected to state debt. So House File 1704. I will move House File 1704 for it being in front of the committee for discussion purposes and the possible inclusion in the capital investment bill. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Krenke. I want you to know, Chair Krenke, I'm trying to do something good for the taxpayers of Minnesota.
That's always appreciated.
Well, I know, and that's so important to you. So what this bill does, Mr. Chair, is provide us some relief for the taxpayers of Minnesota, in my particular case, Fitz Foley, in their repayment of their maximum effort loan. And I think that I need Tim Strom, wherever he might be, to explain what has happened, give us a little of the historical background.
Mr. Strom, welcome to the Capital Investment Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tim Strom from House Research. What's going on with House File 1704 is as follows. There's a school funding program called the Maximum Efforts Program, and that program provides capital loans to school districts with very low property tax values. In 2001, when the legislature reformed the property tax system, a part of that was changing property tax class rates, and the net result of that was a lowering of the state property tax base by about 37%. Because that happened in conference committee at the same time that the school bill was being negotiated, the solution for school tax rates was simply to increase each of the school tax rates by that same percentage, by 37%. The result, however, was a bit of a mismatch because the tax rate that the maximum effort districts faced was quite different from that as the rest of the state. So the result was that the rate that was put in statute, 32%, was quite a bit higher than the rate would have been had it only been adjusted for the tax base adjustment in those districts. So, Mr. Chair, what this bill does is lower that tax rate from 32% to 28%.
Mr. Strom, I guess the key issue for this committee is what is the impact going to be on state debt?
Mr. Chair, there's both a levy effect and an aid effect for this. Your committee's probably interested in the aid effect. Essentially what happens is the amount of the state aid that's needed to pay debt service equalization aid goes down, while on the other hand, the amount of state aid that's needed to for your committee to pay the interest costs on these bonds goes up. So the net is an increase of, let's see if I've got that. So the net, Mr. Chair, is $604,000 increase in fiscal year 06 for your committee of increased interest costs that the state needs to pay on the maximum effort
this
bonds.
Is
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Crow informs me that we are tracking that cost in our committee. So even though for the tails for this year, that'll be tracked in our committee. But then as these adjustments are made after session, that'll move into your area.
You want to, Mr. Crow, you want to have a seat also along with Mr. Strom so we can...
Mr. Chair, we're...
I'm one of those people that gets very nervous about other committees spending this committee's money.
Mr. Chair, Greg Crow from the House Fiscal Department. We're kind of interchangeable, so we could have used one chair, I think. As Mr. Strom noted, there are two aid side effects, and one is on the debt service equalization program. That's the cost and savings are in the... always in the K-12 bill. And then the other effect, it's about a million $1.1 million impact in the tails per year on the cost of debt service. And so that's something that would normally be carried here, but since it's an out-year cost, there isn't a change in the appropriation that this committee would make in a bonding bill for this biennium.
Well, Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, historically, I believe that the this issue has been dealt with in the K-12 bill. Is that correct, or
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. The combination of the levy impact that's tracked with the K-12 bill and the debt service equalization aid impact that's tracked with the K-12 bill is actually larger than the state debt service effect that would show up in the out years as a debt service cost. And so there's policy issues related to tax rates and to the use of this program that the K-12 committee is particularly interested in, and arguably over the long term the impact on the state debt should be minimized because it would just delay repayment of these loans. But if the loans aren't repaid, then over the long term there would be additional costs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, changing from 32% to 28% from the local effort, how does that extend the loans for the maximum effort school loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, the way the loans are issued, they've either been issued for 30 or 50 years, depending on when they were issued. And what the district does each year is it makes the maximum effort tax rate. So currently that's a 32% rate of adjusted net tax capacity. And whatever that raises, they first pay their local bonds with that, if they have any local bonds outstanding from the project. And then everything above the local bond cost is repaid to the state to pay off the maximum effort cost. So what happens in a district like Foley's case, where they're likely to be a district that will repay their maximum effort loan over time, is they'll pay less of the principal and less of the interest in the next several years, but then as they get toward the end of that loan period, they'll be making bigger payments, because once their local bonds are paid off, the full amount will go to repay the state bonds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg. And I don't understand this completely, but I thought there was at least for those loans that are never paid off, or never expected to be paid off. I think McGregor's got one. No, it's all swamp. Then they took the property wealth they did have, which was called the cabins owned by people in Illinois. They took that off the levy, so that doesn't help any. I thought that, you know, if there's a 30-year, then isn't there a cost to the state to wipe those out at the end?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, yes. For some of the districts that won't repay those loans, there is a cost to the state at the end of that 30-year period.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's a lump sum cost to the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, there are a couple of different ways, and we may need finance to speak to how this is handled, because there are a few districts in the state like Red Lake which are very property poor, and I believe that finance has changed their procedure so they no longer have the balance as well as all of the outstanding interest accumulate on that particular loan. But on the other loans where there is a chance of repayment, the balance with any unpaid interest keeps accruing until the end of the loan period, and then the full amount is forgiven.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's forgiven, but it has to be, someone has to account for it. So at the end of the 30 years, there may be, let's say, $100 million cost to the state on a $30 million maximum effort loan. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, in the case of a district like Red Lake, yes, that would be correct.
And Mr. Chair, one other thing: when is the first one of them due? I think McGregor was probably the first school district that had one.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I know there's another capital loan bill you'll be hearing today that their loan is paid off in 2012. That may be one of the first ones that's due. Let's see, on the list of outstanding loans here, we've got, I think, some of these that are 30 years. Barnum, for example, would be 2012. And so that may be one of 50-year. We'll have to check the date when South Kuching, theirs was issued in 1977, but they may have a 50-year or a 30-year. We'll have to double check. If that's 30 years, that would be in 2007. That their 30-year time period would end.
Thank you.
So, if I understand this correctly, gentlemen, that if we were in the private banking business, the government wouldn't allow us to carry for 30 years loans that we never expect to be paid back on the books. But in state government, that's okay. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, there are, as I said, there are two different groups of these. There are those districts that are likely to pay off their loans. A number of these loans have been paid off over time, but there are also a number of districts that are likely not to pay off the loans.
Okay. Did you want to jump in the conversation here, or you just...
He's my buddy.
He says no.
Okay. I could be here for the ride, but well, I'm Larry Werder. I'm the superintendent at Bertha Hewitt Schools. We have a capital loan. We got our capital loan in 1980, and we're probably one of those districts who will never pay it off because of our property poor district. Matter of fact, we're one of the lowest in the state of Minnesota in property wealth per student. And because of that, when the tax compression law changed in 2001, we were the most severely affected by this, to the point that our levy increased 46% that very first year for the capital loan. We'll never pay it off. I think the intent of the legislature and those that asked for this loan back in 1980 or 1979 knew that was going to be true. But with the current increase in the adjusted net tax capacities that have been occurring the past few years, and with the new tax rate, it appears as though the last six years of the note will probably pay back almost half of it. So it is quite an increase the last few years. The first few years, we paid nothing back to the state.
And members, I misspoke earlier. That this bill is not been referred to the Capital Investment Committee. It's still in the K-12 Finance Committee. But I thought it was important for members to at least have some idea that the K-12 Finance Committee is spending us further into debt.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My question is, in the out years, what does that reduce our bonding capacity?
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, either of you want to venture a guess in that?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Silberg, I don't think the bonding capacity has changed as these loans have been issued. Essentially, the issue is the state will continue to make its payments on the bonds whether or not it receives the money from the school districts. So it's an accounting measure between the districts and the state that's growing the balance. But the state bonds essentially are repaid.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one more question? And do we have a fiscal note on this, what the cost of the state is? And is it $1 million? Is that what you said, 1.1 for all school districts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, that's the cost in lost payments from school districts.
Okay.
So there's also a reduction because we paid debt service equalization to these districts as they're making their payments. And those reduced payments will reduce the state's obligation to pay those districts debt service equalization aid. And so the state saves on that hand by about $600,000 a year. So the net total impact of the state general fund is about $600,000 per year.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe we could have Mr. Sawson. I see you paying great interest to what we're doing here. Perhaps you could give us a response to what Representative Solberg asked about. Is there an impact on state bond capacity with this change or in this venue?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Peter Sausen from the Department of Finance. The state, through the Commissioner of Finance, sells the general obligation bonds proceeds of which are used to make these capital loans to the local school districts. The state has to pay the principal and interest on the bonds as it comes due, which we do. Any money that's that is repaid by the school districts goes into the debt service fund to reduce the amount of the state cost of debt service by the amount that goes into it. So if there is less money coming back from the school districts, there's less money going into the debt service fund, which will increase the amount the state pays on these loans. And if the loans are 30 to 50 years, and I'm not involved in the loans themselves, but if the loans are 30 to 50 years, there will be a mismatch between the debt service payments and the payments by the school districts, because our bonds are paid off over 20 years, payments come in over 30 to 50 years. In answer to Representative Solberg's question, the debt capacity, if you're talking about maximum debt capacity, which we calculate based upon the amount of debt service that's available after existing bonds are paid, the debt service on existing bonds are paid, outstanding bonds, after debt service is paid on new bonds for existing authorization, the balance is left for new bonds, for new authorizations. If there's less debt service, there'll be less additional capacity. So capacity would go down some amount based upon the amount of debt service that was reduced.
So the for us novices, the simple answer is yes.
Mr. Chairman, the simple answer is yes.
Representative Erickson, is that what you want to do?
Mr. Chair, the superintendent, no. Mr. Chair, the superintendent of Foley is here, Fred Nolan, and maybe we should hear the perspective from him.
Mr. Nolan, you want to give your name and your position just for the record, please?
Yeah, Fred Nolan, superintendent of Foley Public Schools. Foley Schools is halfway through a 30-year bond. The maximum effort rate is currently above the required debt service. When we do a calculation of the impact of this on the state, at 32% of ANTC, we expect to have our loan repaid in 2013 unless we issue new debt through new bond elections. At 28% rate, we would be repaying our loan by 2015. So the state will, in the absence of new debt, receive its repayment just 2 years later. The difference to the Foley taxpayers, however, next year would be $250,000. Then that's the impact of the increase between 28% of ANTC and 32%. And the reason for that difference has to go back to 2001 and the tax compression and the application of the formula through this calculation. And we can go into that in detail, and Mr. Strom and Mr. Nauman can go into that in great detail if that's what you would like to go, where you'd like to go, Mr. Chairman.
I don't, unless there are committee members that want to go into it in a great deal more detail, I don't think we want to go there, but my concern is that what may be good for Foley might not be so good for the taxpayers of the rest of the state. Some concerns here about, as I said, obviously the longer we stretch these loans out for, it's a little like Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow. I mean, are we in layman's vernacular? Are we not? Isn't this a bit of a what we're doing is a little refinancing here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Tim Strom from House Research. Yes, I think that's what you're doing, because you're lowering the amount that's coming back to the state in the short term.
Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow, how long has this has the rate been at 32%?
Mr. Chair, the rate was at 24% up until the 2001 legislative session, and then it was increased to 32% that year.
And can you give us a little history as to why it was increased?
Mr. Chair, the reason that rate was increased is when the property tax rates were changed in 2001 in the tax bill, the tax base in the state was compressed by about 37%. and as a way to adjust school formulas after both the school bill and the tax bill were in conference committee at the same time. And as a way to adjust the school bill in order to try and not have too big a swings in the amounts of revenue expected from the school levies, each levy that was specified as a rate was just increased by that same 37%. And the issue with the maximum effort loans is the tax base lost in the districts that were eligible for maximum effort loans was much less than the 37%. Most of that reduction came from the lowering of the CI class rate, and there's very little CI property in most of the districts that have capital loans.
Are there any further questions of committee members?
Well, Mr. Chairman, which committee makes the final decision on this? It's in the education finance. They can make the decision, but it's a cost to the state, not in this biennium, but in affects our bonding capacity in the next biennium. So I guess I would like to know how you intend to.
Representative Solberg, that's why I thought it would be important for the committee to hear this. From the standpoint, it does have an impact in out years on state debt or state bonding capacity. The chair of the K-12 Finance Committee and both our staff people here have indicated that this normally has been an issue that has been debated and carried in the K-12 finance bill. So I don't necessarily want to preempt what has been a traditional issue dealt with in K-12 finance, but I think it's important for us to know that this is going on. So, if I hear from committee members that they think this should be an issue in capital investment, then we will make that plea to the powers that be.
Mr. Chairman, I may even have some school districts that participate in this, but my question is on a fairness issue. When it was 24% and was compressed and moved up to 32%, is that dealing with the same level of feeding as what it was before when it was at 24%, or is it 28% what it should have been at that particular time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, the 28% is a match that more closely approximates the tax burden for the districts that are in the maximum effort program. They had about half as much loss of tax base as the rest of the state due to the rate compression.
And is that merely, Mr. Chair, because of the type of district they have, or is it because of general all over?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, it's because most of these districts are relatively property poor because they lack commercial industrial tax base, and the reduction in the class rates in 2001 was very heavily oriented toward reducing the commercial industrial tax rate.
No.
Surprise, surprise. Okay.
I mean, it was a shift from the commercial industrial to the homeowner, right? You don't have to answer that.
These people are not staff to the tax committee. They're staff to the K-12 finance committee.
That was an editorial comment.
Anyway.
It's been used before.
Yeah. If there, Representative Yaros?
Not a question, Mr. Chairman, but just a comment. You weren't chairing the committee. We were in the city of Floodwood. I believe it was your district in 201. I couldn't believe that the entire school, city of Floodwood's tax base is $80 million. That sounds like a lot, but it's about one big hotel in the Twin Cities, or Duluth maybe even. And they have 550 people and about 451 students, because a lot of small schools in the Meadowlands and Warba and so on closed up, so Floodwood had to take care of them. There's no way they could take care of those kids, educate those kids with $80 million tax base. Even Duluth's tax base is larger than that. I don't know how these schools are functioning, how they could function without state aid.
So, I understand. There are no further comments or questions. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming to testify today and Thank you, Mr. Strom, Mr. Crowe. Appreciate the background information.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke.
Just, Representative Erickson, we want you to know that you're putting the state deeper in debt. Representative Hilty, I will move House File 2116 to have it in front of us for possible inclusion of the capital investment bill, another school district issue. Thank you, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, it's deja vu all over again.
Somebody once said that. You want to give us an indication as to what House File 2116 does and how you have the pleasure to appear before the Capital Investment Committee?
Well, Mr. Chair, I appear here at your pleasure. What the bill does is two things. It gives permission to the East Central School District to sell its middle school building, which is no longer required because the district will be opening a new building that includes K through 12 next fall. And the other part of the bill asks for debt forgiveness on the maximum effort loan for the old Astro School District for that building. And hopefully Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom can answer any of the arcane details about this transaction.
I was wondering why they
were... Because, Mr. Chair, I can't.
I was wondering why they were still here, but gentlemen, let's... You want to run through for the Capital Investment Committee members what you've already run through for the K-12 finance members?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Tim Strom from House Research. House File 2116 actually saves this committee money, and the reason for that is that the building that they're intending to sell, the proceeds from that sale will be deposited in the state treasury to repay the bonded indebtedness. If the district did not sell that particular building, their maximum effort rate wouldn't change because of the new school that Representative Hilty just mentioned, so that they wouldn't be paying any more essentially on their debt for the old Ascoff school. So when that loan is forgiven in 2012, if this bill were not to pass and they couldn't sell the building, there would be no more payments from East Central to the state for that building, because the new building in that district is essentially eating up the whole 32% of tax capacity.
I'm always perplexed by how state accounting works. So you're saying that by forgiving a $2.3 million, a $2.3 million loan, we're saving the state money?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Can I get a loan from the state? Okay. Representative Knobloch.
Sure you can, but...
I'm tempted to know what the fiscal note would be if we gave a whole bunch of, forgiveness on loans. But anyway, Representative Hilty, just to be clear, in 2001, we gave your district some money in a maximum effort school loan to replace a school that was having a lot of problems, I think, with mold and such. Is this the school that is being sold, that building that was having those problems, or is this a different one?
Representative Knobloch, the district currently operates three buildings, two of which had mold problems. This is the building that did not.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty. So what you're saying is you built a new school with the maximum effort loan money you got in 2001, and you consolidated students from other schools into that new building. This building is a good building that didn't have mold problems, that is now surplus, that you're proposing to sell.
Yes, Chair, that's exactly correct.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, you want to give me your rationale as to how we're saving money by forgiving a $2.3 million loan?
Mr. Chair, the issue is that over the next 8 years that there are still loan payments due on this school. Because the school district has the new maximum effort loan, and because the way that's repaid is by the maximum effort tax rate, that tax rate will stay at the same place, and the payments will be the same amount regardless whether the ASCOF loan gets paid or not, because they're paying the 32% is just basically is not even covering the new building for the East Central District. And so what happens in 2012 is the loan on the ASCOF building expires, the 30-year period expires, and so the loan balance, whatever it is at that time, will be forgiven. In the meantime, because it's property that's backed with a state loan, that property can't be sold by the district unless the state gives it authority to do that, because Chapter 16A requires the state approval to have that building sold.
Mr. Chair.
So just one moment, if I can try to clarify. So what you're saying is that if we allow them to sell it, we are going to get the $215,000 from the sale, versus if we don't allow them to sell it, I missed that part. If we don't allow them to sell it, what happens?
Mr. Chair, if they don't sell the building, then there would be no payment to the state treasury for that facility. Okay. And because they're at their maximum effort tax rate on their other loan, their overall tax rate and their overall contribution to the state doesn't change.
Help me understand the situation. You're saying that because they have another $19 million maximum effort school loan, the debt service payments are made on that first?
Mr. Chair, that's right. The debt service payments are made on their local bond for their portion of that new high school first. Then whatever's left is sent in to repay their maximum effort loan. But because whether or not this maximum effort loan exists, it will not change the amount of their repayment. So the state still continues to get the same.
I got to get me one of these loans. I can't make the debt service payments on the loan I have, so I get to take out another loan and I get to pay that off, so I don't have to pay the first loan. This is great financing. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was answered. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hausman.
For the author, what's the route of this in the Senate? Is it traveling alone as a policy, as a change that, or is it caught in some big fiscal
question? Representative Hilty.
It's my understanding that it's rolled into the K-12 omnibus bill in the Senate.
Members, I did, just for clarification on that issue, I mean, I did talk to Mr. Marks, our chief fiscal analyst, and it was his opinion that this should, because it deals with repayment of state debt, and this money, this $215,000, would go into the state bond fund. Most likely belongs in the capital investment arena. Now, I said whether it would travel separately or whether it would travel in the bill is probably another question. But Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the accounting of the forgivable part. Who counts it? Where does it get counted? Or does it get counted? And which fiscal year does it get counted in?
Maybe that... Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, do you want Mr. Sousen to try to tackle that one?
That, Mr. Chair, that'd probably be best for Mr. Sousen to address.
Mr. Sousen, it's a busy day for you. As I said, we have another question for you.
Well, you got the expert here anyway.
We got the right man for the job. Mr. Sousen, you hear the question from Representative Solberg. How does this get handled from an accounting standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I'm not the expert on this because I don't know the accounting for the maximum effort school loan and how it appears on the books.
My question is, Mr. Chairman, how much is the balance, outstanding balance on this? $2 million?
$2.3 million, Mr. Representative
Mr. Chairman, if we sell the building, which seems to make sense for $231,000, that seems to make sense, and put that into the rate fund.
Correction, Representative Solberg, it's $215,000, okay. As I understand it.
Whatever that number is, there's a difference in there. And if we would wait till this gets at the end, of, in my previous question, someone at the end of 30 years, there's a cost to the state for those maximum effort school loans. We're moving that cost up a little bit on this one, the way it seems. Or are we rolling it into the next one, the other maximum effort school loan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, from what I heard in the testimony, it's not going to make, cash-wise, it makes no difference. The school building is going to be sold, and I think it's already been sold, actually, for $215,000. That money will come to the state, will go into the debt service fund, and reduce the amount that the general fund has to pay for debt service at the point it's sent in.
I understand that part, but I don't understand the balance.
The balance, as I understand it, though, there will never be enough of a tax levy to pay the balance on this so that the loan will never be repaid, and it's at a future time, whenever the term is up, the accounting people, who I'm not one of them, will write the loan off on the state's books.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in 919 it says it's forgiven, that the other part is forgiven. The day in final enactment, I understand it would be forgiven at the end of the term. We're increasing that, we're moving that term up a little bit with the sale of the building. Or are we rolling it into, would it be better to roll it into the other maximum effort school loans? And if it's forgiven, how do we count that money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, if it's forgiven, then the asset, the loans receivable, will be taken off the state's books at the appropriate time. And be written off, and there's cash-wise, there's no difference. It's, I think the question is, when is it written off? Is it written off in 2004? Is it written off in a future year?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we write it off in 2004, there's no accounting of that. There's no, we don't have to have a negative number show up on our balance sheet.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silver, for budget purposes, I don't think there's a budgetary cost to it.
Okay, that's the question I was asking.
Okay. Mr. Sausen, just you said that it goes into the I can't remember what account you said, but in the language it says deposited in the state bond fund. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? I said debt service fund. The Constitution calls the debt service fund the bond fund, but we call it the debt service fund because it's easier to understand. So they are one and the same.
Okay. Just thank you for that clarification. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sausen. Are there any other questions? Any other information on this bill? If not, I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering,
Representative Hausman,
where will this move in the House? Do we have? Is it in our committee? Does it
the
sitting elsewhere?
Representative Hausman, the bill is in the Capital Investment Committee, so I think the question would be probably Representative Hilty. I guess I would ask you to check with your Senate author and find out if they have any interest in moving this in the either in the Capital Investment bill, so we can match up in Conference Committee that way, or B, if your Senate author would, or Senate chairs could agree that perhaps this needs to move separately. But again, I think from what I've checked with staff in the House is that since the money ends up in the state bond fund, that it really should be in the Capital Investment Committee. And I'm just taking my information from those that know more about this than I do. So, Representative Hilty, I guess, as I said, I think to expedite the situation, please check. I have obviously no desire to impede the passage of this with regard to resolving the issue, but as I said, I think it more appropriately belongs here than in K-12. but the issue might be that it should travel on its own. So,
Mr. Chair, I'll take this up with the Senate, but
Mr. Chair,
can I ask Representative
Eastland? I'm just kind of stuck in kind of the same mode, I think, as Representative Solberg was. These maximum effort loans, when there's bonds that are kind of dispersed, dollars dispersed, and that's kind of part of the equation, is there revenue booked in the state book someplace for this maximum effort loan coming back? Or are these just plain GO bonds, or are they revenue bonds, or what are they? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the bonds are state GO bonds.
So then there is no revenue that's booked in the books relative to those bonds. So then whatever comes in just happens to come in and pads the bonding account.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, yes, and we make an estimate each year of what the repayment from the maximum effort school districts would be, and that estimate is used for our budgeting purposes.
Okay. But Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg,
is revenue booked on it for the payment of the bonds? They have to do that. I mean, like for all of them, the state has got.
But the state has to book the revenue to make the payment. But there is no revenue from the district to the state that's booked in our
estimate.
Yeah. Okay.
Representative Eastland, they give you a coupon book, but if you don't make the payments, no one cares. So. It's a great loan. So I said, that's why I want to get one of these loans. It sounds like a great deal, but we understand that it, I think we all understand that these are what we term property poor school districts that could never build a building unless it was for the this type of a program at the state. So any further questions? Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, just as this progresses, I have a bill in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee that is very similar. It happens to be Representative Dill's bill, if I recall, and it calls for loan forgiveness in a different program. This happens to be rural hospitals. It shows no fiscal note to it, but I suspect, given this conversation, so as you're sort of thinking about the right home for things, right now, it's in our committee and in our bill, and I sort of struggle myself with where the right place is. So
well, this particular bill does have a fiscal positive fiscal impact to the state bond fund, which might differ from what you're speaking of.
It does.
I think Representative Erickson's bill doesn't have a current biennium fiscal impact. It does have a tail on the state bond fund in the future. So, but we'll be happy to take a look. If you'll give staff the number of the bill, we can investigate a little bit further with some fiscal staff as to, not that we don't want it. I don't think Representative Bradley would be happy to let you have it, but this one, as I said, does have a direct current biennial impact on the bond fund. Minor, but an impact.
Mr. Chair, we seem to have more than one place where you take out a loan and it turns into a grant.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you, Representative Hilty. We'll lay the bill. We'll lay over House File 2116 for possible inclusion in the capital investment bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next members, we have Representative Anderson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson. I'll move House File 2267 for possible inclusion in the capital investment bill. Representative Anderson, you want to give us a description of your bill and why we should include it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill that you have before you, people that take out the loans almost always pay them back. So
that's the good news.
That is the good news. This is the Rural Finance Authority bill, and just to give you a brief history, this has been helping small and beginning farmers in Minnesota since 1986. They have different programs that have been developed to serve changing needs of farmers and producers. There have been over 2,200 people that have benefited from these since 1986, And basically what this bill does is it just makes a valuable program for producers available to more of them. And just wanted to talk briefly about the fiscal impact from the fiscal note. It does have some effect on bonding, but I have Wayne Marshloff is here from the Rural Finance Authority, and he'd like to talk about, you know, this program maybe just a little bit and about how this affects the state and also the availability of these loans to farmers. And so I'll, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Marshloff talk about the bill.
Certainly. Mr. Marshloff, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Wayne Marshloff, the Interim Director of the Ag Finance Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The Rural Finance Authority is the primary activity within the Ag Finance Division. And we've developed over the years a fairly efficient system of cooperating with or working with local lenders to provide more affordable financing to farmers for various purposes. The most of these programs that we have are supported by GO bonds, and in due fact, these are user finance bonds because we set the interest rate and the terms on the loan participations, which we cooperate with the local lenders on, to meet the debt service of the bonds. And so consequently, as Representative Anderson indicated, the repayments that are consistent. They do come in and are deposited into the debt service account for the bonds. And in due fact, we do have a loan loss reserve account as well that if any of the lenders do default and do not make full repayment, we are covered through that debt service account. What the bill does is essentially increases some of the parameters that are involved with the various loan programs. There are basically five programs in here that are supported by the bonds. It's the basic beginning farmer loan program, the seller assisted, the ag improvement, the livestock expansion, and the restructure. This the increase in the amount of participation and in some cases the increase in the net worth is going to expand the potential market or availability of these loans. And so consequently, in the fiscal note, we've shown some detailed numbers as far as the projection of the increase in loans that could potentially be participated with through the Rural Finance Authority. To follow that up, Mr. Chair and committee, the agency does have an $18 million bond request before you for the support of these programs. And at the present time, the agency is comfortable with that $18 million. And if these changes in the programs do cause a significant increase in loan activity, then we feel comfortable in coming back to you next year for a supplemental bond request. But at the present time, the $18 million would be sufficient.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that mean that's a higher amount than we normally seek? Because we certainly, otherwise, it would seem as though we'll serve fewer people.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, what the $18 million is basically projected out 2 years. And we have a one-year cushion as far as availability of funds. So, and we used the $18 million as a request because the last 2 years we have closed approximately $9 to $9.1 million in participations. If this change is implemented the day after enactment, we will have sufficient time to experience what the increase in volume may be. So that the $18 million is certainly going to carry us beyond next year. And so when we come back to, if we need to come back to the legislature in 05, there would still be sufficient time. We would not run out of money.
And then, Mr. Chair, just follow up. And if you don't get the $18 million but we pass this language, then you would be serving
Mr.
People.
Chair, Representative Hausman, if we do not get the $18 million, we will not be servicing anybody. Because it's the proceeds from the bonds is what we utilize to buy participations from local lenders.
Or what I was thinking is, like, let's say you got nine, then it wouldn't that there's a level at which you would be serving fewer people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, there at a point we would just virtually run out of money. We take the applications as they're eligible on a first-come, first-served basis. The procedure has been, for the last two times anyway, is that every 2 years the agency comes to the Capital Investment Committee for an additional appropriation for two more years. Part of the problem is that we don't want to ask for too much because there's a four-year limitation. If we receive an appropriation today, by 4 years from now, we have to have that utilized. And so we're trying to balance, as far as in the projections, we're trying to balance what our needs are so that we fully utilize any appropriation that's granted within the four-year period. So we're just looking 2 years ahead is what we're trying to do. If we do not get the $18 million, we would be running out of money within 2 years then.
And then, Mr. Chair, I guess I wonder why the bill is a good idea then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, what the bill does in itself is increases the parameters for additional farmers to be eligible to take advantage of this particular program. Right now, for instance, the net worth, right now there's two elements here. One is the maximum participation. We buy 45% of a loan up to $125,000 under the Basic Beginning Farmer Program. What this bill does is raises that from the $125,000 up to $200,000. So consequently, with the land values increasing as they are, quite often our 125 maxes out before the 45% does. So with the increase in the participation increases, that means that certain farmers are going to get additional benefit. The other part of this is in the net worth. Currently, and it is indexed, currently the net worth eligibility is $274,000. This bill raises that net worth eligibility up to $350,000. And still keeps the index. So consequently, there's going to be additional farmers there that will be eligible because of the increase in the net worth. So we're projecting that in due fact there'll be additional applications, there will be additional farmers that will be eligible and will be assisted with these programs.
Either Representative Anderson or Mr. Martsoff, can you explain on page 3, there's this new language on total net worth limit. What's the impact of that language?
Mr. Chair, that particular provision is under the Ag Improvement Loan Program, and the net worth, we asked this language to be put in so that it balances with all the other programs. We have been setting the net worth on by rule on the Ag Improvement Loan Program, and this way it puts it in the statute just like it is with all the other programs.
So, in other words, what you're saying is this identical language is in rule, or is there a change from what's in rule to what what is being looked at to be included
what
in statute?
What this does is that it puts it in balance with all the rest of the programs. What we've been doing is with the Ag Improvement Loan Program, using the same net worth that was established by the Basic Beginning Farmer Loan Program. They're aimed at the same group of farmers, so consequently we've been utilizing the net worth that's been established under the Basic Beginning Farmer Program to fit also with the Ag Improvement Loan Program. And this way, we want to put this right out front, right, so that it shows in statute that they're comparable.
I'm sorry, but I don't have the fiscal note. Can you give us the what the suggested additional how many additional loans or what the total additional capacity you foresee with this provision?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note shows that if this bill passes as it is, we're projecting approximately $2.7 million in additional participations annually.
And is that then, I think this goes back to the previous question that Representative Hausman was asking. So is the $18 million that is being requested for the Rural Finance Authority inclusive of that $2.7 million or exclusive?
Mr. Chairman, it is exclusive. Is that request, the $18 million, is the request that was established on the basis of the current existing parameters of the loan programs.
Okay. Are there any other questions by Representative Eastland?
Yeah, I just have one question. What's the current performance of the program? Are there defaults out there, or what's happening with this program and the payback, and are we forgiving these loans too?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, the default rate on this is very small. It's similar to any other loan that a bank would give, and the reason for that is that the lender is 55% responsible, you know, for the loan, and so they're the ones that do the credit checks, and so they go through the same process as if you or I were going to go get a loan from the bank, and so it's no different than default rate on any other loan that a bank would give.
If I could follow up with that, Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, we basically were sharing the risk on these loans with local lenders, and they are the ones that originate and do the initial credit checks and do the initial credit decision. To get more specific to numbers, however, is that the performance of these has been rather outstanding, and that we provide a report quarterly to our board, and it shows that as far as delinquencies are concerned, on a delinquency standpoint of over 30 days, it's usually about 1 to 1.5% are more than 30 days delinquent. From an actual default standpoint, where and when there is a default, the local lender does all the servicing, handles all of the legal matters as far as that loan is concerned. It is based on real estate. We take a first mortgage on real estate as security for these loans. In normal circumstances, the sale of the real estate will fully recover. On the few instances where the real estate does not cover, we do have a loan loss reserve that then supplements or transfers funds from that loan loss reserve to the bond servicing account so that we are meeting our obligations. Simple answer is, the state is not forgiving any of these loans. We're fully paying them one way or another.
So the revenue, I mean, as the loans are repaid, then the revenue flows back into the general account of the state as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, that is correct. This is not a revolving account. It's once out, once back in, and goes into the account for debt service. Bond service, I think, is the term that's being used.
Representative Eastland, do you?
No, fine.
Okay. Any further questions? No further questions. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
We will lay over House File 2267, Postal Inclusion Capital Investment Bill. Next members, I'd like to have Representative Knobloch present House File 3105. Members, I would move House File 3105 to be considered for possible inclusion in the capital investment bill. Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3105 is a fairly simple bill. What it does is allow the ownership of the Paramount Theater in St. Cloud to be transferred from the St. Cloud Housing and Redevelopment Authority to the City of St. Cloud without them paying back the $750,000 grant that they received in bond funds in the 1998 legislature. The Paramount Theater was a structure that was kind of our grand old theater in St. Cloud at one time. It fell on hard times. It was restored and is a beautiful theater now. In the 1998 bonding bill, the state gave $750,000 to us, and the city has determined that because of some of the continuing subsidies they need to put into the theater, that it would be better for the city to own it rather than for the Housing and Redevelopment Authority, because it's strictly not a redevelopment-type project anymore. The project is done, it's open, it's operating, and we have a provision in law that says that if you are transferring a project or selling a project once bonds have been given to it, that if you sell it, you've got to pay off the bonds. Well, here we've got a entity that's basically transferred between two sort of similar St. Cloud civic entities, and we're asking to not require the bond to be paid off since the use of the theater is still remaining the same and there's no functional change in what's happening. And I got some individuals from the City of St. Cloud, Mike Williams, our city administrator, and from the St. Cloud Housing and Redevelopment Authority, Bruce Tillman, who can provide additional information as needed.
Gentlemen, you want to give us your perspective on the situation? I know Mr. Knobloch's given us the Cliff Notes version, but why don't you give us your city version?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I really don't have too much to add to Representative Knobloch's description. We desire to make the transfer from ownership in the Paramount Theater from the HRA to the city, and again, that will this bill will transfer that grant that was given in 1998 so that it follows the ownership with the city and exempt us from some of those requirements. I can answer questions, but I think it's been well described.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who would need to answer this, but I'll just pose the question. The way you described the transfer and everything, Representative Knobloch, you noted current subsidies, and I could speculate as to what there might be for good reason to transfer it to the city, but I'm wondering if there's a possibility that those subsidies would be reduced by this transfer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, I don't believe that they will be, although that's really, and I should mention these are not state subsidies, these are subsidies from the City of St. Cloud, but perhaps Mr. Williams can speak to that more.
There's really two ways that the city contributes to the theater, and one is repayment of the debt that was incurred at the time of the improvements and the improvements to the theater, and then there is a subsidy, if you will, on an annual basis that takes care of the operational costs of the building, and part of all this is to get our arms around that subsidy that goes towards those operating costs as well. But at this point, the agreements that we have really keep those at the same level for this year.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is for the author. I'm trying to think if there is any precedent that we set for other projects that would have a similar designation that would leave us open to problems. I mean, this is, granted, this bill is very specific to this project, but sometimes when you set a precedent, someone else says, oh, that's a good idea. You've written a few of these bills, so you probably know if there's anything out there that would be.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I mean, in a way, we almost just saw one earlier today in that the Hilty bill, they are selling a school, I guess, in his district, and thus using the proceeds of that school to help pay down their obligation. I mean, if they were actually to sell this building ever to a private vendor, I mean, it's a beautiful, wonderful theater, and I would encourage anyone who ever, you know, wants to come to it, I think you'd really enjoy it. I mean, this the $750,000 was a small fraction of the $5 million that went into renovating it from a variety of sources. But in that case, I think the school, I gather, is being sold to a private party of some kind, and the school is now going to have a different purpose. Here, the purpose remains the same. It's being sold from one governmental entity to another, and I would suggest that the precedent, I don't know that I would worry about a precedent here, because you've got the same use carrying forward, and it's from one governmental body to another. And Mr. Williams says he can add something.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, there is a little bit of history that might help answer that question as well. When the grant was first allocated in 1998, it was actually in the name of the city, and the next year, because we wanted to keep the ownership with the HRA, we passed a very similar bill to this one to keep the grant able to be granted to the HRA. So this will be going back to the original bill.
In other words, they can't make up their mind.
I didn't want to put it that way.
I was, Mr. Chair, just trying to think, how might I apply this to my city? But
you want to transfer some things? Representative Murphy, do you have a question?
That theater being used for, and are attendances as good as you anticipated when you came for the $750,000?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think what I should do is defer that question to Mr. Williams from the city or Mr. Tillman.
Maybe Mr. Tillman.
Mr. Tillman, you made the trip down. You might as well get a chance to get recorded in history.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. The HRA ran the theater basically since 1997. We were part of the renovation. It is a beautiful theater. It would be similar to the State Theater in Minneapolis, except it's a little bit smaller scale. And its attendance has been very, very well received. It's a regional arts center. It's got not only cultural events for the local theater groups, but we also have the Paramount Theater itself presents different acts, and then there's community activities such as arts and painting and drawing and computer labs and clay work and all that sort of thing. So it's, I don't have the numbers, but it's very outstanding the way it's been put together and the way it's being run, and we're real happy with the way it's worked out. So again, if you go back to the original structure, the community came up with $1 million and the HRA bonded for $4 million, and then we asked the legislature to give us $750,000. And the city pays back the debt service on the $4 million bond through their food and beverage tax. So the city's been intimately involved anyway, so it just makes sense that the HRA is a redevelopment agency, and it's time for us to step back and let the city become the operator of it. And so there's just the small little clause that Mr. Sausen discussed with us, and he would be willing, I'm sure, to come down and add his testimony as well. But we decided this was the right thing to do because it's just a transfer between the two public bodies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is the city going to does the city have a board to manage it, or one person, or
there's
do people have input?
Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the city is in a little bit of a transition on the management, but there's a Paramount Arts Resource Trust, which the city will contract with to manage the services and the programming of the building. And so there will be that close relationship with the city. And then sort of the day-to-day operations, the building's operations is rolled into with our civic center. So there's some close connection. This is making some closer connections with the city in the management of it.
Representative Murphy, a follow-up?
One more question, Mr. Chair. And then when the city gains control of it, then the city will be responsible for the upkeep of roofs and the furnace and the new chairs and all that stuff at the time that it...
I think Representative Murphy wants to know if you're going to come back to us and ask us for any more money to maintain the facility.
The city will be responsible for maintaining the building. That's correct.
You heard it, Representative Murphy. You're never, ever coming back for any more money before the committee. Isn't that right, Representative Knobloch?
I'm not sure I'd hold them to that. Mr. Chair.
Well, it's worth a try, wasn't it?
It's worth a Chairman, try. I wouldn't dare come back before your committee and ask for any money for this.
Okay, any further questions? If there are no further questions, we'll lay over House File 3105 for possible inclusion in the capital investment bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. Now, standing in for Representative Thiessen, the Right Honorable Representative Larson, House File 2096. Welcome to the committee, Representative Larson. Chair will move House File 2096 to be in front of the committee for possible inclusion of the capital investment bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You're right. I'm sitting in for Chief Author Representative Thiessen, who is in another committee. And so I'll give a brief introduction to the bill and turn it over to Todd Nolenberger, who is a member of the Richfield School Board, who can describe why we've come to you with this legislation. Basically, this bill addresses a fairly infrequently used provision in state bonding law. It addresses what happens to property in which the state bond money has been used when that property is sold. This legislation is only concerned with the part of the law that applies to a property or an improved, partially improved property that was done partially with bond money and then partially with monies from a separate entity, so a partnership, if you will. Current law states that the division of the sale proceeds is made in the following order of priority. Number one, the state has repaid the amount of state bond money that was contributed to the project. Number two, private lenders are repaid on their loans. And then number three is the portion that we would like to amend in state law, and that's the part that's the remainder, which is split up between the contributing parties, and in this case, the state being one of those contributing parties. Currently, under current law, the value of property that has been partially bettered by state bond funds, the value is determined at the time that the improvement is made for the state's purposes. For the other entity's purposes, their value is determined at their time of investment. So in this case, in Richfield School District's case, and this was an improvement that was proposed to a historical society site in Richfield, the Bartholomew House, which was made in the 1960s, so clearly not a market value rate today. And so what we'd like to do is change the law so that the value for the local entities part of this is made at the same time that the betterment occurs. And I'll let School Board Member Nolenberger give you the facts as they relate to the Richfield situation with the Bartholomew House.
Superintendent, welcome to the committee. Again, just your name and your position for the record, please.
Chair Krenke, thank you. I'm actually a member of the school board. My name is Todd Nolenberger.
Sorry about that.
Not at all. I don't want that job.
I can understand that.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and hopefully clarify our position with respect to this bill. The Richfield School District's interest in this statute stems from our ownership of the Riley Bartholomew House, which is the oldest home in Richfield and is recognized as an historic site by the Minnesota Historical Society. The school board has owned this property since the 1960s and has no intention at this time to sell the property. However, we are being asked to accept a Minnesota Historical Society grant in the amount of $12,100 on behalf of the Richfield Historical Society, which will be used to improve the property. If we accept the grant, this property will become state bond finance property subject to the requirements of Minnesota Statute 16A 695 for as long as the 20-year state bonds remain outstanding. Our action was we tabled an acceptance of that grant because we're concerned about the fact that the state, the Historical Society, and the school district would effectively become partners in this property during the 20-year repayment period. And our partnership contributions, based on current law, would be valued based on wildly varying points in time, going back to our original cost in 1965. We support the House File 2096 because it would change the basis upon which the shared contributions to the improvement of a property would be calculated. As amended, the contributions of all parties would be based on the appreciated value of the property at the time the grant is made, rather than at variable points in time. Kind of the crux of the matter here is what I've used in the past to explain this to people is if you had purchased a home in 1960s for $20,000 and it has appreciated grossly, as most properties in this area have, I came to you today with $20,000, said let's put some new siding on and go partners 50-50. You probably wouldn't be very interested. So that's, to me, that's the issue here, is that we're more than happy to be partners with the state on this. We have no intention to sell the property. However, we don't feel that we can bind future boards to a partnership that is not done on a just basis.
Questions by members? Mr. Sousen, since you've been so kind to join us several times before today, how would you like to come down and give us the Department of Finance view on this House File 2096?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Peter Sousen from the Department of Finance. I talked to representatives of Richfield as they were discovering this, how the way the state law worked, I think last fall. And I agree with them that the way the law currently stated for their property, which goes back to the 1960s, is unfair to them, and the Department of Finance would support this amendment to the law.
Mr. Sousen, are there other situations that you could see this provision impacting, or either positively or negatively to the state?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that there are many cases out there where the state has provided grant monies to local governments, state bond finance grants to local governments that have gone into old buildings that may have appreciated in value, but I do not know. I don't have another example of that.
So, in other words, you don't know of any properties that the state may have given grant or loan monies to that might be up on the auction block and this might impact?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know that, and my discussions on these grants that I'm involved in, the discussion of the sale of the property isn't something the local governments even are considering. They expect to own the property forever and ever until it's no longer usable. So it's never been an issue before. No, it's never been addressed before until Richfield did this last year.
Any questions then for Representative Hausman?
Mr. Chair, again, mine is just the issue of how does this travel, because it's, and maybe we know how it's traveling in the Senate, but it seems, since it's not a fiscal impact, is it an issue that should travel separately?
Representative Larson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, actually, Mr. Chair may have better information about its progress in the Senate. Since this is Representative Thiessen's bill, I'm not sure how it's traveling there. And I'd be happy to inquire with Representative Thiessen about that.
The only issue that I know of is that because it dealt again with repayment of state bond proceeds, that it belonged properly in front of the committee. I haven't discussed with the authors what the progress or where it is in the Senate. Representative Larson, do you know that?
I do not know that, Mr. Chair. Something that we'll have to find out.
The staff informs me that Senate Finance passed it and sent it to Capital Investment. So whether they intend to incorporate it into the omnibus bill or to pass it separately, I guess that would be, again, ask the authors to inquire with the Senate authors and Senate chairs to get some indication. But for the time being, I guess I would lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus capital investment bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I was told that the only question that was asked in the Senate was, who was Bartholomew?
Do you want to give us that point of reference so we know who we're
Mr. Chair,
who we're honoring?
Well, fortunately, because of time constraints, we've lost the member of the Richfield Historical Society who was here. Happily, he was there in the Senate, so he was able to answer that. Mr. Bartholomew was, as I understand it, a general who retired in this area and became a farmer. And built his homestead, and as I stated earlier, the house that we're talking about here is the oldest house in the city of Richfield and has been preserved as a historic site. It is used in conjunction with some school district programs in order to teach history to the children, kind of an on-site preserved location where they're able to actually step a little bit back in time and experience the way that things stood over 100 years ago.
The maybe I missed this somewhere, but it is adjacent or on school property currently?
It is owned by the school district. It is run by the Richfield Historical Society. It is actually located on Lindale Avenue, just north of 70th Street, which is roughly kitty corner to where the Richfield High School is located. So it's the house is on a rather significantly large piece of property. The house is utilized by the Historic Society. The remainder of the property is maintained and utilized by the school district as athletic fields.
Very good. If there are no further questions from committee members, thank you, Representative Larson. We'll lay over House File 2096 for possible inclusion in the capital investment bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Next, find my agenda members. Next, we have Representative Pennis. Representative Pennis has introduced House File 3105. I'm sorry, House File 2822. Don't want to give you the wrong piece of legislation. Members, this bill is in the Environment Policy Committee, I believe, Representative Pennis, but yes. Because it deals with state land acquisition, a lot of which we are considering in the Capital Investment Committee, I thought it would be helpful for members to hear Representative Pennis's view of how we should approach the purchase and sale of state land. Representative Pennis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I hope you wake up. I'm a little tired. I lost a little sleep over this bill, but I had lost a little sleep over the situation beforehand, too. Today, right before I came down here, the Department of Natural Resources did provide me with some maps, and so if the page wants to hand them out, you can maybe take a look at them. We'll talk about those later. This bill originated out of frustration. I was asked, when did I think of the bombshell? And my answer was, I think it was in the middle of the night one night. And it came out of a little bit of frustration of asking, how much land does the state own? Where is that land, and what's its designation? And furthermore, what is the goal of the state? How much land should we own, in fact, own? How much can we sustain? Receiving none of those answers up front, I threw this in the hopper and did not request a hearing. And so, to my shock, it showed up yesterday that you want some information on it, and I will give you what I have, which is not a whole lot. The land that's not covered in the bill, which is still land out of the tax base, is federal lands, local unit of government lands, wildlife organizations, of which some do pay taxes, some don't, other nonprofits, and so on. There's a breakdown on the map of the one that Minnesota's horizontally on.
This is the map entitled Minnesota Public Land?
Yes, which shows land from United States, the Native Americans, DNR, and other Minnesota agencies, then would include the state land, the green and the orange, and then county, and then the no administrator code could be various things. In speaking to DNR beforehand, it might include the conservancy land, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, and other entities. Notice the dates on the map. It's data from 1976 to 98 with data from 1983 to 85 predominating. On the other map, which is state-owned lands in Minnesota by land type, as of January 11, 2001, a little newer map, you can see, if you look on that, and you look up in the northwest part of the state, where my frustrations come out of. I own with my husband about 1,040 acres up there, but you don't have to go very far before you come onto some state land of one type or another. Part of my frustrations was in asking the questions I did, not getting the answers that I did not get, was when FSA can detect 0.3 acres, which is a rock pile on open 80 acres of land, which is our field, and say, you know, you don't have 80 acres there, you have 79.7. And then I'm told that, and they're doing that off of satellite maps, and then I'm told, no, we do not have an inventory on state land, what type, what kind, where, and so on. And being able to access that easily, I guess I was asking, where is it, what is it, and so on. I will say that just dropping this into the hopper has brought various people through my doors. Now, what was my reason for doing this? Well, I'd like to see as much land as possible kept on the tax rolls. I do believe in private ownership. I do believe that we should be good stewards of the land, and I do believe that private people are good stewards of the land. And then, as I said before, we need to determine how much land the state can actually manage properly and at what costs, because I certainly know that invasive species can get loose in some of these vast tracts of land. If you look across, and if you can imagine Highway 2, if you don't know where it is, it's about here across. Okay. If you look north of Highway 2, you will see that we don't own a whole lot. We, the people. We, as a whole, do, but as individuals, do not own a whole lot. One would ask if this is reasonable for the whole state based on the northern third. Well, it seems to be that's what we do in most things down here, one size fits all. I will stand for anything.
Representative Pennis, can you, for us city kids who don't necessarily, you know, land to us is called the backyard. We go out and we mow it every now and then, mm-hmm. but... Can you give me a definition of on this Minnesota public lands map you handed out? The black areas, it says no administrator code assigned. Is that sort of like in limbo? That
no,
you're supposed to mow on the weekend.
I think I'm going to ask for some help on a good definition.
I have trouble mowing what I got now.
The thing is, if you look at these maps, They're very speckled, you know. They're very spotted, and I know you all know what an acre means. I'll tell you what an acre means. An acre of WMA, Wildlife Management Area, to me means pilt payment. Okay? That was $2.71, but
pelt. Is that
bill?
Like a fur pelt or is that
pelt,
like a,
not
oh,
pelt.
Pelt. Oh,
if
pelt.
We could go on there and do trap them out, we'd probably get more per pelt. But
payment in lieu of
taxes. Okay, payment in lieu of taxes.
Yeah, we like
this,
that. Okay.
Yeah. This guy tells me, I'm sorry, Paul. Paul, yes. Paul tells me that this coming year it's going to be $3.84.848. Now, you know what an acre is. Everybody's got a concept. Take an acre down here, any place you want, however many lots, and tell me what you can do for infrastructure on $3.84 for that. And then, Mr. Chair, you wonder why I come down and I ask for money? Well, I'll tell you, and 48% of what was upstream of Rosa was state land that helped flood it. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, can we get back to the definition of no administrator code assigned? That was the question.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a map that was put together.
You got to give us some sort. This isn't the Environment Policy Committee.
I apologize.
Give us your name and position for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Pojar. I work for the Department of Natural Resources, Lands and Minerals Section.
Thank you. Now give us the explanation. Thanks.
This is a map that was put together under a federal program. What they did is they tried to put all the different public ownerships together on one map. And it was done, as noted, over a period of time, and the information, some of it is 30 years old, some of it is as recent as maybe 8 years or so ago. You asked specifically about the no administrator code. This is one that it's a quasi-public use. This would be like the TNC, the Nature Conservancy, has gone out and purchased lands. It's not totally public, but it's not private land. And so there are a number of these across the state. There's a few up along the Iron Range that are mining company lands. I believe probably Blandon has some lands in here as well, forestry type lands.
Okay. Representative Erdahl, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question of the witness. What land type is Volstead?
Thank you for asking that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Representative Pennis, you want to just give us the abbreviated definition here so
okay.
that members don't have to try to page through the information you handed out to find it or point out where it is in the information.
Okay, and maybe Paul can tell you. It's on the second page at the top. And it's a type of consolidated conservation acres. And it... In fourth line down, in 1908, the U.S. Congress passed the Volstead Act that permitted the establishment of liens on public lands in Minnesota's drainage districts to cover the cost of ditching when the lands were ultimately purchased. And so it gets its name off of from that. But they are within the CONCON lands. Am I right in all of them are?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, that's correct. Roger. The Volstead lands were lands that were owned by the federal government. The CONCON lands were lands that were available to the public. There was problem with drainage ditches and the cost of drainage ditches. The federal government agreed to have liens placed against their lands. Later in the century, in the I believe it was in the 70s or 80s, the federal government made these lands available to the state of Minnesota to purchase, and we did purchase a portion of the lands that were made available. So we treat them within the department as acquired lands. We acquired them from the federal government. This is different than granted lands or lands that were granted to the state from the federal government.
So, back to a question, Representative Penis. Can you give you kind of gave us a quick overview? What is it that you truly would like to see? I mean, I understand that this bill is likely not going to move through the process this year, but what would you truly like to see in terms of an outcome here?
Mr. Chair and members, what I'd truly like to see is a map. I would like to see an inventory of the state land so that we could take a look at it and what we own. What I have found out a lot of problems with, you know, what I have down in the bill. There are various types of state land, and this says state land. So it would include such things as the DNR managed land, which we've talked about, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the university system, the MNSCU system, the corrections, Department of Corrections, Military Affairs, Administration Department, and Human Services Department. And so suddenly, I've learned a lot about what implications this could have on some of those. If the Department of Human Services, for example, were going to sell a building to the University of Minnesota, would they in fact want it if there were taxes associated with that building? So certainly when you're dumb, you learn a lot. On the other hand, I think it's pathetic in the days of GPS and satellite photography, satellite imagery, that we do not have a better handle on our lands, whether they be nice and square and in sections or curvy. Run around them with a GPS unit, but for gosh sakes, don't use a TATV.
But Representative Pence, what you're saying here in this legislation is no net gain. So you're not talking about just an inventory. What you're saying is that, if I'm looking at this legislation, you're saying that the state, in essence, could not acquire additional land unless they sold or disposed of land.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that was my idea in order to keep land on the tax rolls. Now, at this time, first of all, if you're going to say no net gain, I sound like I'm talking against this, but I really think there's a lot of things that have to be done first. One is, if you don't know what you got, how can you, you know, even if you acquire some, how can you sell? I mean, we don't even know what the total amount is. And then, secondly, after, you know, finding out the different types of state land, certainly I do not, it was never my intention that the university system should pay taxes on one building that they got from the Department of Public Health or, you know, that type of thing. So I think this is, you know, this is a start, and I would hope that we would get some map making up to date and an inventory up to date.
Representative Anderson, my memory serves me correctly. We tried to move this issue forward in state government finance bill several years ago. Do you want to give us the, want to refresh our memories as to what the outcome of that was?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, we were kind of in the same situation as you were, Representative Penis, but I think about 2 years later, I received a CD that said on it, inventory of lands from the Department of Administration. So if you're not doing anything for dinner, come on over. We'll take a look at it.
But, Representative Anderson, that doesn't give us a... What were you trying to accomplish, and what was the outcome?
Well, the the outcome is the same thing. I mean, the purpose was to try and find out where our lands were located in the state and who had control over them and so forth and so on. And we were basically not given any information as to what and how. It showed us that, just like your map showed us, there are lands out there, but to give us detailed information about that, we went nowhere.
Mr. Chair, I think...
Representative Pettis.
I think I can say from visiting... Paul, what's your last name?
Paul Pojar
here. That, of course, when they acquired these lands, whichever way, whether it be tax forfeit or purchased or whatever, they had to get a legal description. So you've got a detailed legal description, which you need to match with the land. And I don't know, I think that's part of the rub here. Either you get a stack of legal descriptions, but in fact the surveys have not been done on some of it. Would I be correct in saying that?
Mr. Chair, representatives, I think each of the different agencies that were mentioned have a good handle on the lands that they own. The Department of Natural Resources does. We know where our lands are. What there hasn't been is a compilation of all these different lands. You mentioned the CD-ROM representative, and the reason it's on a CD-ROM is we took a look at our obligations under the law that you had mentioned earlier, and we would have had to have printed over 2,000 pages of paper in order to meet that obligation. We asked administration, do you want us to send a truckload of paper over, or we can send you a CD-ROM? They preferred the CD-ROM.
Well, Mr. Pojar, in my conversations with people from the DNR is that you made the statement that you know where all your lands are. My information has been from a variety of people that that's not true, that we really don't know, that we don't know some of the boundaries. I mean, we know that there's a parcel somewhere. I mean, we know there's a parcel located in X township, but we do not really have a definitive boundary on what that parcel is. So when you say you know where it is, you know where it's located, but my understanding is that because some of these lands date back maybe 100 years, that we do not have a boundary definition for that property. Is that correct or incorrect?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would agree with you that to go out and find a piece of land on the ground may take a surveyor to follow the description in the legal documents that we have. When I was speaking where we know where our land is, on a legal document we know where it is. To actually find it on the ground, yes, you would probably have to have a surveyor go out and locate it. As I believe you pointed out earlier, we received some of these lands over 100 years ago. There's been nothing done as far as subsequent surveys on many of those lands since that original land survey was done by the federal government.
My understanding, though, Mr. Pojar, is when this issue was discussed several years ago, is that those boundaries that were put down in a survey definition, in other words, so many feet from the lake shore or a river boundary, that boundary could have changed over the last 100 years, so that therefore we don't know exactly where that boundary is. Is that correct or incorrect?
Mr. Chairman, what they did was they located posts in the ground or metal pins in the ground, and the description of those pins where they were located might be from a big rock or a certain type of tree, and you would measure from the tree over easterly so many feet to find the pin that they placed in the ground. This is the way surveying is done.
Mm-hmm.
over the years, the trees have grown, the trees have fallen over. We would have a heck of a time in the boundary waters with the 500,000 acres or so that blew down trying to find those locator trees or the stone or whatever they referred to. You are correct. It is difficult to go out and find some of these locations, and you would have to send a surveyor out there to follow the directions in the original government surveys to actually locate where these pins are located.
Mr. Chair, might I also just add, MnDOT, I taught GPSing in high school, and MnDOT gave us their geodesic marker sites and said, gee, go out with the students to see how many you can find, because that would be a help to them. Well, I tell you, you have a certain amount of luck, but farmers plow them up, elevators scrape them out. Usually along railroads you can find them, and if it's a good bridge, it stays there, and it's a mark. So the if you got it according to a tree or something else, I would say you do not have an accurate survey. I might also add that there are some WMAs up in my area that are evidently resurveying because they're causing me problems, because, you know, if it's moved over a few feet, who gets the call? Wrong person.
So. Okay. Maybe we all need a class in mapping or something, so we... Not napping, Representative. Yeah. Napping. Anyway, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just a clarifying question. On line 20, I've been sitting here trying to think, what person would be exempt from taxation? Person that is exempt.
Do we want to have counsel try to tackle under Article 10, Section 1 of the Constitution?
Is there a copy in here?
There's always a copy of the Constitution. It's in the statute books.
Maybe it's just a drafting. Maybe it's a word that.
Well, while we're.
So anyway, that's my one question.
We can have
those lines 20 to 23 were not clear to me because I couldn't think of a single person who could be exempt from taxation. But my bigger issue about the bill, I guess, is the reality that you describe is so different from the one that I have had in my years of committee. I don't sit on environment anymore. I don't sit on LCMR. But one of the challenges is this is a very expensive proposition. And over the years, through LCMR grants and others, we've just gradually been trying to get more and more sophisticated. But it's not through any incompetence, it is lack of, I mean, it's just slow amount of money that we gradually enlarge our ability to just focus. But on the issue of lines, I would say this is an issue beyond government. And let me just tell you a quick story about a constituent who called me, and he has had this property for over 15 years up north. And for whatever reason, he decided with his own money, because of you talk about different things stuck in the ground over time, he paid $4,000 for his own survey of where his land would be, which gives you some sense of the cost. And what he discovered was the lines that survey came up with were different from the ones that he thought. And guess what? That meant someone else had been living on his land for over 15 years, and we have a law in this state called adverse possession. Mm-hmm. And when this was discovered, that owner could go to court and say, I want this land, and I'm going to get it, because we have adverse possession, and this property owner has no recourse, because we don't even say in our state law, of course, if you've been paying the tax on it, you don't lose it. So this other owner is going to get 5 acres of his land,
His attorney says there's not a thing he can do about it, so he has just lost 5 acres of land. I tell that story to say we're suggesting that somehow the government has, or the DNR is doing something wrong, but I think private property lines and surveys have been flawed over the years also, and so there's a certain lack of specificity, but mostly it has to do with we would need huge sums of money to be absolutely sure we could study every inch of the state and report in an instant about that. And so I think I understand the issue, but as I understand it, we're moving about as fast as we can given fiscal constraints.
Boy, I'm learning all sorts of good stuff here today. Yeah. I want to get one of these state loans that I don't have to pay, and then I want to go find some land that I can live on. In 15 years, I can own it. Boy, that's a great deal. As I said, I'm all sorts of ways to prosper in the state of Minnesota. Ms. Dyson, you want to give us the constitutional reference that's on lines 20 through 23?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, first, I want to say the use of the term person, when it's not otherwise defined, includes corporations, associations, municipalities. It's under Chapter 645.44. It's defined to have a broad meaning. So that may be part of the concern, but the constitutional reference in Article 10, Section 1 provides the list. That's the section of the Constitution that says taxes shall be uniform on the same class of subjects. And it continues on, but public burying grounds, public schoolhouses, public hospitals, academies, colleges, universities, all seminaries of learning, all churches, church property, houses of worship, institutions of purely public charity, and other public property used exclusively for any public purpose shall be exempt from taxation. And so that's covering the constitutional tax-exempt properties, but I think what confused you was the definition of the term person.
And then, Mr. Chair, just a final observation, I guess, and I can hear some of the frustrations, but what I don't know if we're going to be hearing from people in the audience who are you asking for people to testify for or against the bill? Maybe there are people who, but my guess is at the very least that sportsmen would oppose it, because my understanding is as urban areas encroach on the land that sportsmen are always looking and eager to preserve some of the land that would otherwise go into private hands because we need to preserve habitat. So that's just one of the things that occurs to me. And
Mr. Chair?
Representative
I hunt and I fish, and you know it's a family tradition in that, and I certainly don't oppose owning land for hunting and fishing. And when we talk about buying more WMAs, you know, I just say not in my area. But so no, I understand that, and my feeling is that we need to get a hold of what we own, where we own it, and it inventoried. Now, I fully appreciate what you said, Representative, about the cost net. And again, I can, I suppose, plead on the side of ignorance. I just thought that more was available with the GIS that's in place, you know, how our districts are remapped and blah, blah, blah. It didn't take too long. And I understand there are things that does not enable them to do that as well. However, that being said, if you can pick out a rock pile on 80 acres and determine it's 3/10 of an acre, I think we need to look at some of that use of satellite photographs and stuff too.
Amen.
Who said it?
I think the chorus is singing amen. Mr. Pogger, what these maps don't include, I presume, is the land we heard from Bowser at previous committee hearing, that there's 1.7 million acres that are under CRP. So that does not, since those are taxable lands, that so any land that is under state easement is not indicated on the map that was handed out that state-owned land. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Representative Pennis?
Now, CRP acreage does pay taxes, though. Or maybe that was clear to everybody. I just want to make sure it's clear.
Right. Mr. Pogar, can you give us or point us to what the DNR's land management policy is?
Mr. Chairman, we follow the direction of the legislature in a lot of our management policies. There's a number of bills before you this year talking about various different trails. It could over time include parks and that type of a thing. So we follow the direction of the legislature. There's constantly people coming into our offices and your offices, I'm sure, as well, constituents who have interest in hunting and fishing, boating, and so forth and so on. They're looking for areas to recreate and hunt and that type of thing. So we listen to the public, and we follow the public's lead and the legislative directive as well.
So in other words, I'm not familiar with all of the statutes, but so you're saying that we should look to the statutes for Minnesota's land management policies?
Mr. Chairman, there are a lot of directions within the policies or within the statutes on how land is managed. The Minnesota Outdoor Recreation Act, for example, identifies various different types of lands, from forest to water access to aquatic management areas. And there are requirements and criteria that have to be met before those can be named into those different management units.
But that's the use of the land. That's not an overall land management policy. It has nothing to do with the percentage of acres or definitive number of acres. That's just that's what we would call utilization type of policy, correct?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would characterize it as that, yes.
So just to clarify, the state owns or has control over, well, state-owned lands, according to this compilation, has over 8 million acres of land, and we have no land management policy?
Mr. Chairman, the numbers are actually about 5.56 or so million acres that the Department of Natural Resources is responsible for. There's about 2.8 million on this map that the county is responsible for the management of those lands. On the 5.56 million that we manage them according to the best use of that land within the areas that have been identified in the Outdoor Recreation Act. So forest land that has been identified as best use for forestry, we manage it in that way.
When Bowser was before the committee, they said that they had a strategic plan that or their goal under their strategic plan was to have about 2.8 million acres in CRP. Does the Department of Natural Resources, to your knowledge, have a strategic plan with how many acres the state should have any of these categories?
Mr. Chairman, I have never heard of any plan where we've identified a target acreage that we were going after. I do know that there have been some targets established within some of the outdoor recreation systems. For example, the scientific and natural areas have identified a number of target, maybe not so much acreages as types of land that they want under their management.
Mr. Proger, what's the under Representative Pennis brought up WMAs. Is there a, for example, under the wildlife management areas, is there a goal or some sort of a target in that area?
Mr. Chairman, I think there are a number of wildlife groups that represent hunters, fishermen that have identified targets that they wish to have the state be involved with acquisition on.
But my question is, I'm talking about does the department, in other words, we have the legislation seeking $20 million. I mean, do we know, does anybody have an idea, $20 million, is that just $20 million this year and maybe $10 million in 06? I mean, does anybody have a plan for where we're going with this amount of acquisition? Uh-oh, it's phone a friend time.
Mr. Chair, I have seen the percentages for different areas on that.
Percentages of what?
Percentages of the, I assume it's on the dollars, because you would have a hard time to say I'm going to buy this many acres because of the difference in price per acre between, say, southwestern, northwestern, northeastern Minnesota. So I'll turn it over to you.
Welcome.
I think. Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Director of Legislative Affairs, the Department of Natural Resources. The policies and information you're looking for are contained in our conservation agenda, which sets out our strategic plan and goals for this administration. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy with me right now. I will get you a copy. It's also available on our website. From the main page, you can get there. I will bring a copy back in tonight if you would like one.
I have a copy of this administration's current bonding requests. That's not my question. I'm saying, does someone in their breast pocket or in their concept of how much land should go into various categories of either A, state forest, wildlife management areas, we know that the trust lands are, that's a we debate those on a regular basis, but that's a fairly fixed number. Some believe it should be decreased, but what I'm saying is there somewhere the strategic plan that says that this is what we are looking to in terms of the optimal number of acres under certain categories or under certain plan? Does that exist at DNR?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, there is a goal. Goals established that we have established in that document. Also, the Citizens Advisory Committee that Mr. Pojar discussed recommends an accelerated goal of acquiring 210,500 acres of new wildlife management areas within the next 10 years.
So
the funding proposal before you and the governor's recommendations would fund approximately 11,000 acres. The new wildlife management areas.
Okay, so in other words, what you're saying is that the document that you're talking about, the strategic plan for acquisition, is not this year's request. Am I correct there?
Mr. Chair, this year's request is a portion that is contained within that document.
Whatever help I need to try to figure out who's planning to acquire how much land is what I need. So can you get me that document?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's all I need. Thank you. Are there any further questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, could you tell me
How many hunters or how many sportsmen we have in the state of Minnesota since you're with the DNR?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, those numbers vary depending upon activity. Off the top of my head, I believe there's over 400,000 licensed deer hunters in the state. Roughly 2 to 3 times that amount in licensed fishing people. Small game and other registrations I don't have with me right now.
I presume that's also available on your website?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Has the DNR been tracking that over time as to how many we've had and has it increased or decreased? And because I've been reading a book lately about planning, and we're talking about planning for how we manage the state's resources and things like that. It seems like city planners and county planners and stuff have come up with a formula as to how many square feet or how much land each person could reasonably live on and, you know, survive. Do you do something like that as to how much land you need for sportsmen and fishermen and stuff like that?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not aware of anything right off the top of my head that I could give you that deals with that. The issues that we deal with concern the amount of private opportunity that is lost each year to people who are participating in hunting, fishing, bird watching, hiking, things of those natures, which help us to decide and determine the amounts of land we try to acquire.
Well, my concern, Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, and members, is that I have many people in my new area that I just annexed that is now more rural area than it is city dwelling, which I had more of, that they are concerned that the DNR and others, other entities that have been mentioned here, Nature Conservancy and other people, that they're purchasing land, taking away land out of production and things like that, but the management of it, they don't see anybody taking care of it and helping them to maintain or to, have more conservation officers out in the field managing some of the complaints that local residents have in the rural areas, and they're very concerned that if they continue to purchase more land, that they can't monitor these violations that they're concerned with, that they're concerned about more purchases for the agency, the state of Minnesota. So I'm just trying to get some idea of how you guys come up with formulas or how you plan for purchasing more land and what on what basis, what's your criteria that you come up with for determining that you need more.
Mr. Meyer, you have a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would be happy to provide you with more information. I don't have that information with me at this time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any further questions? No further questions. Thank you, Representative Pennis. I will just like to... I'll give you this little document. It's from the Manifesto of the Communist Party... from 1848, not a document that I peruse with any regularity, but it states here that the theory of communists may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property. So I'll give this to you so you can use that in your efforts to try to find out how much public land there is in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pennis. Representative Anderson, Representative Tinglestad, you have comment, question?
Just on that happy note, Mr. Chair.
I always like to end on a high note, yes.
I just have a question. I think, isn't it pretty unusual that Representative Pennis's bill came to this committee when she didn't even ask for a hearing? And I have a couple bills that I didn't ask for hearings, and I'm wondering if they're going to be coming to this committee too. So should I be preparing for a hearing? Or?
You never know what may show up here in the Capital Investment Committee. It's just... It's just a sort of a grab bag of fun and excitement. So
okay, thank you.
So always read the notifications of what is on the agenda. So be forewarned is foretold. Anyway, Representative Anderson, would you please move the minutes from the March 16th and March 17th meetings?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any comments, additions, deletions to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, minutes are adopted and meeting is adjourned. And members, we have no committee meeting scheduled for tomorrow because we have session at 3 o'clock. So we haven't figured out exactly where we are. Members, we're waiting for the action of the of the Ways and Means Committee to find out what our target is for trying to put together a bonding bill before we endeavor to put one together. That hearing is going on right now. So
yeah, at this point, we have no Thursday and Friday.
At this, stay tuned. Meeting adjourned.